disagree with what you said on the traveling church. I'd like to bring up another situation and have you comment on it. That is, sometimes people are converted some distance away from the church, and it's impossible for a year or two for them to get moved to where the faithful church is. Say they're 100 or 200 miles away, and we do have some situations like this sometimes. I'd like you to comment on them communing part of the time at home. Maybe once a month they might get a need, feel like they need the fellowship at the larger congregation, but we just got one couple here that are babes in Christ and would like to carry on a communion two or three Sundays out of the month that they can't make it the 100 or 200 miles to the other congregation. I'd like some comment on that, please.
Well, from what I've seen according to the scriptures, we have no authority to observe the Lord's Supper just as a personal Christian. Just because I'm a Christian gives me no authority to practice something that God states must be done under certain conditions. For instance, the frequency of the first day of the week is a condition that must be met in order for the Lord's Supper to be observed, I believe, according to the scriptures. And I also believe a congregational necessity is part of that tradition that was delivered by the apostles. So in that situation, I believe it would be a violation of pattern for them to take it just individually, just because they're Christians. I believe they need to identify with the congregation in some way, shape, or form.
Doug Edwards.
Enjoyed your talk very much, Glenn. I want to ask you a little bit about what you mentioned about the evangelistic work, being able to go off away from established church. Like, really just for you to comment on that a little more about, you know, if you send a preacher off to a new area and there's no church there, and he goes ahead and worships with his family or whatever is there until another church is started, or two preachers go off into another area. Could you just comment on that a little bit more as to why that might be different than somebody going off on vacation?
If there was any one question I anticipated, it was that one. here goes. Whenever someone goes out to establish a congregation, I believe that they forfeit their identity with the congregation that they've left. If a congregation sends out someone from that congregation to establish another congregation, because of autonomy, they cannot be identified, I believe, with the congregation that they've left. The traveling church violates that pattern because people I do identify with the congregation that they've left. They are not out there for the purpose of evangelism, unless it's to preach to every creature sometimes out in the woods. But the point of the matter is that it's not fulfilling the design, and it does not have the purposes and design of a congregation, that is, of leadership and eldership. But when two evangelists go out to establish a congregation, their purpose and intent is to establish a body of Jesus Christ with the design of leadership and organization, and to fulfill the responsibilities that were delivered to the church of Corinth. So for that reason, I do believe you have to have a specific, there has to be enough number to commune, there has to be enough number for a body to function as in disfellowship and a church to function correctly, and that might be as low as three or four, you know. But the fact of the matter is that they are trying to establish a congregation, and it's not just there for the purpose of convenience. And because of that, I believe God approves of that kind of arrangement. For evangelists and those establishing congregation, I believe it, the purpose and intent is different than the roadside church.
Glenn, I don't think you got a hold of Miles' question a while ago, and I want to re-ask it, and if I'm asking it incorrectly, Miles can correct me. But assuming that you have two or three people in a company that have been sent out, separated from a church, to go out to establish another church or to preach the gospel in an area in hopes of establishing church. All right, they identify themselves over here, away from this home congregation, we'll say. All right, what if they meet there for 6 weeks, and then on the seventh week, they want to go over here someplace and worship with a congregation, and all three of them go, and they haven't gained a member. Now, can they do that?
Oh.
Now, that's what I'm
Okay. I didn't fully realize that.
Thank you.
as a congregation, I believe that your responsibility to your purpose would probably bind you to staying in an area that you're trying to establish a congregation, because if you've been doing evangelism, you would anticipate those who would visit and come and preach the gospel. But
believe me, it gets kind of lonesome.
Yeah.
You get to wanting to go.
I can't really. Did somebody have a better answer for that? If I went out to establish a congregation and there was only three or four, I believe I would feel responsible to that until I could. I would not leave it unless we were disbanding. I would not leave it because I believe we would be doing work there and anticipate those who are visitors.
Melvin Blaylock.
Yes, Glenn, back to something you mentioned at the beginning of your lesson. I just wanted a little bit of clarification on it. In 1 Corinthians 11:33, where he speaks of tarrying one for another.
Yeah.
Now, how do we obey that? How does that affect us today? I realize something you were saying back there, but...
One brother, we were talking about this before, about how to anticipate that. How long should we wait today for someone to come to the assembly? If they've forsaken the assembly, then how long are we going to await their coming, or look for them, as the Greek says. Basically, I think the basic idea that Paul is giving here was correcting some practice that the church at Corinth evidently was observing, and that was they were taking their own supper first. And evidently what they were doing is they weren't concerned about anybody else. They weren't concerned about anybody else in that congregation. They were just concerned about themselves, and so whenever they decided to eat, they'd eat. But Paul says, when the Lord's Supper is being observed, that's no longer to be part of your practice. You await one another to get there. You anticipate each other's coming. So to be real specific, you know, I think that we should just await. For instance, if the conditions are such, for instance, snow are such, if you have weather conditions that are rougher than usual or whatever, I believe it's extremely appropriate and in accordance with the intent of this verse to postpone and to wait until you have a good idea that's just about everybody there. That's about this.
But that's not a situation for the typically delinquent church member who's delinquent about coming in, that sort of thing.
Right.
Okay.
Glenn, before that goes any farther, I want to disagree with your interpretation of that. I don't understand that passage like you do. That doesn't mean that I'm right and you're wrong. That just means we don't quite see that same. But the point that you were proving has been proven well. You can't tarry for anybody in any sense unless it's in a congregational capacity, and that's your point. So I don't think that I'm going to introduce what I believe about the passage, because that's not really at issue on your subject. What you were saying is that because they were told to tarry for one another, now regardless of what the sense is that they tarry one for another in, that tarrying one for another would be impossible if it were not in congregational capacity. And even if I'm right and you're wrong, and you missed the mark on the tarry, you proved your point. And I'd rather not see us get bogged down over that one little word, because you proved that without a congregation, there could be no tarrying one for another. And that's the essence of your lesson.
Well, he says, therefore, when you come together, to meet. So,
right.
Tell them to come together.
And that definitely has a bearing on your subject. And you did fine in proving your point. Just disagree with what I believe. But Jimmy Smith.
Glenn gave a good talk in answering to the still on Miles. In essence, you have affirmed that you could disband permanently, but not temporarily. Where's the scripture? Now, I'm not through yet. You're probably better in the Greek, a whole lot better than I am, because I want to ask, what's an infinitive?
Raymond, you want to? infinitive, according to Robertson's and Thayer's and those that I looked up on it, it just basically, well, I can't basically say it.
Okay. In the some of the digressive papers, they've been battling some of these new versions. And I know you quoted from the Greek on Acts 27. Some of them been arguing or affirming now that day is not in the original Greek, is it?
No.
Just say up on the first of the week. So.
Just a second. Yeah. Yeah, the word day is implied there on the first of them. If I'm not incorrect, it's the phrase there is what they interpret first day of the week. It's the phrase. But day is very definitely implied. What's their basic argument about attacking the word day?
Well, it's just where they condemn certain new, like the New Americans, our New King James Version. You know, they've just been saying some of it's not according to the Bible, and they'll go back to the others. They'll just finally whoop them all, beat them all to pieces, you know, to show that, well, because this word's not somewhere else, this one's not in that, and it's all I know about it. But would you like to deal with Christ communing, which we get in, like, with the individual cup people, too, there, and the joint participation? Would you like to deal with the aspect where Christ has no need to commune, or no part in actually communing in the Lord's Supper, participating in his own death?
I'm basically talking about someone who is a bread breaker persuasion who believes that Christ did not partake of the communion.
No, see, we say they're not communing because they got individual participation.
Oh.
They say we're communing between the individual and Christ.
I see. Well, my basic comment would be that in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, there in that passage, the apostle very definitely establishes the fact that they are to respond to each other as one body in Christ. And on in the passage, I mean, the broader context of 1 Corinthians 10 was that they could not have fellowship with one another in Christ and have fellowship with demons and demon worshipers at the same time. And their practice of observing it with the church and with demons, a couple of demons or whatever it is, failed to show who they were in fellowship with. Failed to show who they identified with. And he says, we can't identify with both of these. You've got to pick one you're going to identify with. And he tells them to identify with the body of Christ or the church at Corinth. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but I believe 1 Corinthians 10, verse 16 and 17 is a very strong argument to show communion with one another rather than with Christ. I mean, it implies it's also with Christ, but those who partake of that loaf with one another in the church are the ones who are showing the joint participation of the fellowship one with another in that passage.
I present two things to you that I've come across and get your reaction to it. Of course, in this part of the country, most brethren don't have to worry about being transferred from one part of Oklahoma or Texas or other such places like that without having a church in close proximity. But I've lived in areas where I've gotten long-distance phone calls. People say, hey, I'm being transferred to such and such a place. What's the nearest church? And I'd look on my map and say, well, 300 miles, 400 miles. And I said, well, do you think I can commute there? And I said, I'd tell them what to do and everything. And I explained to them, you cannot have a temporary church if you're being transferred by a job to work in an area. And then after a few weeks pass, if they finally get up there, they get tired of driving that, and they just start meeting temporarily until the job is over. I'd like to have your comments on that.
I think it's extremely dangerous for a Christian without the intent and purpose of establishing a new congregation to be a far way away from fellowship and from the unity and from the blessings of the congregational capacity that's being taught in 1 Corinthians, the 11th, 12th, 14th chapter. He's there showing them how they can each contribute of their strengths and their weaknesses, and on in the passages in Ephesians and in Romans 12. He tells them they're supposed to have the same care one for another, and they're supposed to look out for one another's welfare and become parts of one another. And you know, I just can't be a whole body by myself. I need somebody sometimes to be able to correct me whenever I'm going away or wrong or whatever, you know, and to watch out for one another, to care for me, to share my burden, and to double my joys. And it's very, very dangerous, I believe, for a Christian to be isolated from fellowship.
Okay, let's take that one step further, because I begin to see this happening, especially some of the reports in the papers. A fellow goes somewhere, either for a job, school, or somewhere, and the nearest church is several hundred miles away and says, hey, I'm up here either working or I'm going to school. Let's get a church started. And the idea is they may be there for 6 months, maybe a year, or the duration of their school. Are they really wanting a church to be established in the community or just for the time that they're going to be there for their job or their school, and then they're gone, and then what happens?
Right. I think that their main purpose should be not their secondary purpose for assembling. Their main purpose should be for the purpose of evangelism and to establish a church. There are some people who view, now I just want to make this a point here, there are some people who view their jobs as a way to accomplish evangelism. Like Paul, and I use the illustration of Paul being a tent maker, and because he was a tent maker, he could take his job with him when he established a church and support himself, as he did in the scriptures. You know, but his main primary purpose was to establish the church, and his secondary purpose was to make money off tents. But there are other people who've got those reversed. They want to accomplish the first purpose with the secondary thing with the church.
I agree with you there. One last thing, and then I'll be finished. This comes up every now and then, especially in the northern parts of the United States. The idea of snow was mentioned a while ago, waiting for people. Accidentally, I've run across situations where a heavy snowfall will come Saturday night, continuing the Sunday morning. A few people are able to struggle to the church building, quote, and they have a service there, and others say, well, how can we get there? And I know of a few incidences where they got to someone's homes. They met in individual groups and had communion, and I told them that that'd be unacceptable. If you can't have it in a single place, then I believe that you're exempt. Would you make comments on that?
Well, it snows in Nebraska. As far as a specific locality, or let's take it one step further, a sanctuary argument, where you have to do it in a holy place or in a place set aside for that purpose, it's very evident, according to the scriptures, that they meant homes for the purpose of worship. And when Paul says, have you not houses to eat in, there, some people see a great contradiction there. You know, well, we eat the Lord's Supper, eat in the same place. What do I do? You know, but the point very specifically is it that regardless of where the church met, they met and assembled. And whenever they assembled as the church, that was considered the place where the Lord's Supper could be observed, regardless of the location. Everybody evidently that were members of that congregation knew of the location and therefore could assemble. Now, let me give you an illustration, okay? Let's say all the church at Imperial lived at Binkelman. Not all of them do, but a lot of them do. Upon that occasion, the Imperial area was socked in with 6 foot of snow. I mean, if we're going to exaggerate, we're going to hypothetical, let's get it really up there. And where nobody in the Imperial could get out, but most of the members were at Binkelman. If they wanted to assemble in that situation, it might be approved of God, because the people in Binkelman Imperial couldn't even make it to Imperial, couldn't even get out their front doors, per se. But in other situations like that, for instance, if there are people assembling at the church, and I've got a creek that runs in front of my house, and that proverbial creek rises to the point where I can't make it to the assembly of the church, I believe I have absolutely no authority whatsoever to observe the Lord's Supper in that situation. And I might desire it, I may want to, but I have no authority as an individual Christian to do that. If I am separated from a congregation, I know that congregation's assembly.
Delmer Lee. Ryan Fox.
Glenn, I think your answer about temporarily disbanding was very adequate, because, as you said, a congregation has certain purposes for being a congregation, and anyone who establishes a congregation, even though they may be the only ones there worshiping, has to realize the responsibilities that they have of being a place in that community to worship God, where other people can come to commune. Their evangelistic responsibilities, and that there's no doubt about it, that's a tremendous responsibility to take on, a very lonely responsibility. But nonetheless, you've taken on the responsibility of establishing the Lord's church there in that community. And if some terrible circumstance might come up, that some circumstance beyond your power that would draw you out of that community on the Lord's Day, then there'd be no reason, I believe, that you could not make preparations for having someone there to, as your substitute, to maintain the congregation's status of a place to worship in that community. But there's no question about it. It's a tremendous responsibility. But that's what the responsibility is. And I think, too, your answer was very adequate about someone going off and working in another locality. They need to make the Lord's church their first priority. And I think that's the real issue. Are they making the Lord's church their first priority or not? And what if their job discontinues? Well, if it means that the church is their priority, it means that despite the fact that job discontinues, if they're needed in that community to further the Lord's cause, they'll stay there. If the Lord's church is really their priority. So, thank you, Glenn.
In fulfilling that responsibility.
Jerry Dickinson.
I want to follow up on what Raymond said, because when I lived in Victoria, we had this very problem at times, because in the summertime I would go off to hold meetings and there would be one man left. And I felt it was my responsibility to get somebody to come. Now, we lived about 100 miles from the nearest congregations were 100 miles away, Houston and San Antonio. So I would have someone either come from San Antonio or from Houston to help out with the services, because there was only one man left and he was a new convert. And of course, I don't believe, as you pointed out, he could commune by himself anyway. And so I felt personally that that was my responsibility to make sure if I was gone and if everyone else was gone, that someone should be there. Personally, I did not feel it would be right for me to write something in the OPA and say, well, we're closing up for this. The next two Sundays, if you happen to come by, we'll be gone. The church is closed up. I believe, as you pointed out and as Raymond pointed out, it's our responsibility. If we're going to take on that responsibility, it's our responsibility. Something else I wanted to point out, if I may, is in Acts 20. You know, Paul said at this time, he was in a hurry to get to Jerusalem. He wanted to be there for the feast. This money that he was carrying and so forth. He was in a hurry. But we read in verse 6 that he sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread and came to them to Troas in 5 days, where he abode 7 days. And then upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together, he was with them, ready to depart on the morrow. He was in a hurry. And so I wonder, if he was in such a hurry, why did he wait 7 days? Obviously, he arrived either on a Saturday or a Sunday. And he observed the Lord's Supper with them that Sunday, that first day of the week. And then he waited 7 more days until another first day of the week and observed the Lord's Supper with them again. And then he was in a hurry, and therefore he departed quickly on the morrow. Well, obviously, Paul didn't believe that he could just do it somewhere on the side of the road. You know, this would be an ideal situation for a traveling church. He's in a hurry. He has a mission to accomplish as a preacher to get to Jerusalem. So maybe he could have thought, well, we need to get on to Jerusalem before the feast, so we'll just go on Wednesday or Thursday or maybe on the next Sunday. We'll just meet. This company will meet together. But no, Paul believed that he had to stay with. He had to be where that congregation was assembled. So I think that reinforces what you said.
Alan Bailey.
Glenn, I appreciate your comment. The digressive church that has communion morning and evening services both. I'd like to comment on that. And also, in your studies, have you come across what you figure is the earliest time a church can have communion, come out daylight hours or evening hours, whatever, the earliest and the latest? Could you comment on those 2 points?
Well, I could. it's off the subject. I really don't want to get into it very much, but I believe Leviticus 23:32 establishes that Jewish system of keeping time voice from sunset to sunset. And whenever the term, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, sabbatone, or I'm probably not getting it, but the term translated first day of the week is used, it uses Jewish time as a reference for that very word. So I basically believe the first day of the week starts at sunset, goes to sunset the next day, and the earliest possible time would be sunset on what we call, according to our time, Saturday evening. But that's not really I'd rather be safe than sorry anytime on that kind of judgment, though.
His other question was about split communion.
I believe that's absolutely unscriptural due to the fact that they were to meet together as one body. Now, two bodies can use the same building, but that's not the way they practice it. That two congregations can use the same location, but that's not what they're saying. They're saying one body would split communion, and that violates the pattern, I believe, of 1 Corinthians 10.
Because the congregation, if they had people who could not make it for Sunday morning, whatever reasons they want to give, could they have communion on Sunday night and not have it on Sunday morning?
I don't believe so.
Sunday evening service or whatever, if it's before sunset. Could they have communion then instead of 10:30 in the morning, have it 5 o'clock in the afternoon?
You mean an entire congregation have it
the
5
entire
o'clock
congregation.
In the afternoon? Yeah, if that's the time that the Lord's, if the congregation, one of the translations of the word congregation means to bind, to covenant, if I'm not incorrect, to covenant together. And if a congregation covenants together that that's the time they want to assemble, they should be cautious about being the first day of the week, according to that. But I believe any time is appropriate, if it's within that time frame, the first day of the week.
Jack Cutter?
In some instances, I think maybe what probably can occur, and that is the Bible gives us precedence, and there are sometimes there are exceptions. And what I mean by that is that there are unplanned incidents that do occur that the Bible just doesn't give us any enlightenment about. Now, as far as worshiping, we all understand that. But if a snowstorm comes or a flat tire on the way, or if half a church can gather, what does the other half do? Or if passing the communion cup around, somebody drinks all of it or drops the bread and it breaks in several pieces. The Bible just doesn't deal in those areas. Those are exceptional areas. Now, I used to think that we had a precedent in those areas, but what they do, I understand, I've talked to Jerry about Africa, sometimes those Africans will drink all there is in a cup. And they use their judgment over what to do because there's several hundred there. We might even do differently in that situation in the States because it's an exception. And so what your judgment is in one area, one way or another, might be different in another area and not be anything wrong with it. Because what we do generally is what we're supposed to do, but the Bible can't deal in every imaginable situation.
I agree totally. You can have the same number of people in one situation, they be the church in another, and that same number of people can also not constitute an assembly of the church as well. And you have to determine purpose and intent and a lot of things whenever we're talking about these situations. One thing that I might point out in talking about that is that even if there is an exception, it does not change or in any way augment the rule. The rule is still the rule. An exception is just an exception to the rule. For instance, death. It's pointed out men once die. Enoch is an exception to the rule. There are exceptions to the rules, you know. But the rule still is in this situation, you know. I might make a side point here. In 2 Corinthians 8, verse 12, it says, "For if the readiness is present, is it acceptable according to what a man has, and not of what he does not have or has not?" And sometimes I believe that there's a big difference between forsaking the assembly and not being able to make it as well. It's the same idea implied in this passage. For if the readiness of mind is there, in other words, I have a willingness to go, I have a desire to go, but I'm hindered in some way, then I have not chosen to forsake the assembly, you know, and therefore it would be accepted. Whereas in another situation, it might not be accepted because of a willful mind I chose not.
Ron Corder.
Glenn, this is just a comment that goes along with talking about what Jack had just mentioned, but I think there's something here that is worthy to remember. You know, Jesus said, "I'll have mercy and not sacrifice." And the Bible gives us the general rules, the general situation. Now, when we do get into a circumstance that is beyond our intent and beyond our control, then at that point we are at some liberty to make a decision. And I think in those cases, we have to be careful about saying, there's no authority to do that. That's the only thing I want to emphasize. Now, if I cannot get to the assembly, it's beyond my intent and beyond my control. Now, I'm not giving anybody loopholes, okay? But I'm talking about beyond my intent. Let's talk about this snowstorm if you want. But once it's beyond my intent and beyond my control, absolutely without a question of doubt, I'm now in the realm I'll have mercy and not sacrifice. And if my family, I think, conscience-wise, then determined we were going to
partake the Lord's Supper, we're in that particular sphere. And since we're in that sphere, I don't know if we can turn around and make the statement, I have no authority to do so. I don't say that to make a loophole, but I do think it's important that you've got to get the total balance. And life does have those situations. I'll give this illustration just to back it up, not to try to justify it. But I had one circumstance in Africa where in traveling to one place, we ended up in circumstances absolutely beyond anything. The fact is, to get to where we could go, I was pretty glad to get out of there with my skin, to tell you the truth. We got back finally to our abode. My wife and I discussed the matter. And we went ahead and we prepared the communion. But I don't believe I had to. But what I'm just illustrating what I mean by I will have mercy and not sacrifice. But once you get in that realm, you're going to turn around and say to someone, you had no authority to do that. I think we must be careful, because then you can begin to build a man's tradition and not an apostolic tradition.
The apostolic tradition was for an assembly of the church to practice the communion though. And if such is necessary for the pictures in the Lord's Supper to be portrayed accurately, then I believe that would be a violation of that. That's what I believe. I believe that I, as a personal individual Christian, would be suspended from observing the Lord's Supper on that day, and because of hindrance and God not requiring that of me, rather than going ahead and establishing something that the apostles evidently had opportunity to do, but refused to do it. We have no example of them in Acts the 17th chapter when Paul was a prisoner, in Acts the 20th chapter, verse 6, which many interpret as Paul missing the assembly there and having to wait 7 days. Paul didn't take the Lord's Supper on those occasions because he could not assemble with the congregation.
Yeah, the only point I was trying to make was that in those cases, the matter of authority, you know, to bind the authorization is all I'm pointing out. That's the statement I'm trying to make. Something.